Good morning, almost afternoon, and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and happy Aloha Friday to you.
Happy Friday to you, Beth Ann. Looking at Oahu this morning.
Looking at Oahu, and a lot of what we heard from the mayor last night. Mayor Kirk Caldwell gave his vision for keeping Oahu from becoming, as he put it, a de facto gated community. And he says, you know, the linchpin is affordable housing. Again, last night, we heard him make that commitment to, in the State of the City address, to create more affordable housing. And that's seemingly syncing well with the chair of the Honolulu City Council. Ron Menora says his top three issues are rail, affordable housing, and homelessness. And, of course, all three of those are intertwined. Ron Menora joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
As you heard the mayor speak last night, were you sitting there sort of ticking off on your sheet of issues that were well in sync with what you have as your priorities? Because it seems to be from what your top three are.
Yeah, so I was very pleased with the mayor's speech to the extent that he really highlighted affordable housing. I think that the issue has reached crisis proportion. There's a severe shortage of affordable housing, especially affordable rentals. So I'm glad that he's going to be giving it a high priority, and the council looks forward to working together with him, but ultimately giving a very careful review of the proposals that he submitted.
What do you think of his proposals in the way that he was calling for a great deal of collaboration with government and the private sector, nonprofits, pretty much every aspect of our life?
Well, you know, I think he's definitely moving the city in the direction of addressing our island's affordable housing needs. You know, the council has recognized that there is no single panacea to addressing this issue, that in an effective action plan to develop more affordable housing needs to include a multifaceted and multi-pronged approach, which includes public-private partnerships. So to the extent that the mayor's proposals encompass this approach, the council is very open to receiving and reviewing his proposals in the near future.
He talked a lot about being able to make it easier for a developer to develop a project that would allow for affordable housing units, more of them, to come online. We've heard about that before. We've talked about that before. This time around, do you feel that there is something, the momentum, that would make this happen differently than we have seen it happen in past?
There's no question. I think there's strong momentum. And, you know, the mayor's office clearly provides pivotal and crucial leadership. So to the extent that he's come forward and exerting a very proactive leadership role in promoting this agenda, I feel very optimistic and confident that there is a momentum to, you know, look at the regulatory process and to try to streamline it for affordable projects. But there are other aspects of the mayor's proposals that I like. He talked about providing city financing to leverage state and federal low-income housing tax credits, making city lands available for affordable housing development, and building infrastructure and providing incentives to facilitate affordable housing projects in TOD areas, and that's a connection to rail. So all of his proposals, I think, are moving us in the right direction. They're a significant step forward, so we look forward to working together with him to try to address this very difficult and complex issue.
You sound very positive with the way all of these things are intertwining and the confluence of rail and obviously transit-oriented development. Affordable housing is being a big component of that. Homelessness also being part of what is being addressed by this, or what might be addressed by this. Did you have any issue with what the mayor had to say at all, or in the way in which some of this was being posited?
No, and you know, he did mention that the lack of affordable housing is one of the contributing factors, a major contributing factor in our homeless situation. So clearly, if we can make more affordable rentals available, it's going to benefit, many of the working families or individuals who, unfortunately, because they lack the resources to pay the high rents that are being charged in the market, that by creating affordable rentals for this population group, then we are, I believe, going to be making a significant, making significant inroads to reducing our homeless population in the future.
We talk about these terms affordable housing, but in terms of the numbers, you know, what one would have to generate in income to be able to afford that, either for rent or to if someone could even purchase something, which seems to be kind of out there for a lot of people who are just looking to get a roof over their heads. Do you think that these numbers are reliable?
Well, you know, the mayor is going to be basing the definition of affordability based on the HUD, federal HUD, or Housing and Urban Development guidelines. So for various income categories, it calculates what families earning certain income levels can afford in terms of rents or various kinds of housing costs. So the mayor is focusing on individuals and families whose incomes fall below 80% and below the area median income. So in effect, for example, you're talking about families, you know, earning less than $65,000 a year. And for them, you know, when you consider the other costs that they have to try to deal with, in addition to housing costs, it's so very difficult for families who earn income in this category to be able to afford the rents that are being charged in the marketplace. So I think the mayor is moving in the right direction in terms of the population groups that he's trying to address, the low income individuals and families who can't afford the rents that are being charged. However, I think that what the council may want to consider is increasing the percentage of rental and for sale units that developers would be required to set aside as affordable units to increase the percentages that the mayor's proposed, especially since under the mayor's proposals, developers would be provided with generous incentives, to develop affordable housing. So the numbers of the council will be taking a close look at. But I think in general, the mayor's proposals provide a framework within which we can work to address this issue going forward.
Ron Manor, how much or how many more units would you like to see?
Well, you know, we really are in a very difficult situation. You know, right now it's been estimated that we need 25,000 housing units to accommodate the housing needs of our population, out of which over 20,000 need to be built and developed for low-income individuals and families. So we're talking about thousands of units. So we're far behind. And we're not going to be able to build these units overnight, but clearly we got to make inroads and at least build a significant percentage of units to address these needs in the future.
But if he's saying at least 800 affordable units every year during his second term, and you'd like to see potentially more units being made available to those who would be, you know, in a lower income point, how many more would you like to see? What do you think is really feasible?
Well, again, that's why we're going to have to give the mayor's proposals a thorough vetting. And during the course of public hearings, the council members would like to ask that very question of developers and affordable housing advocates. I mean, 800 units a year, you know, is a significant step forward, but I'd like to see a lot more being built, obviously, because, again, we're thousands of units short. And so we'd like to get more input from the developers, the affordable housing advocates, as to what is realizable. But the council's goal is to try to exceed what the mayor has proposed.
And some of this is definitely going to be hanging on what happens with rail, so we'll be checking in with you in the future. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Appreciate your questions and the opportunity to participate.
Ron Manor is chair of the Honolulu City Council. He represents District 9, including Mililani Town, Kunia, Iroquois Point, and portions of Ewa Beach.
Aloha, this is David Ige, Governor of the State of Hawaii. For 35 years, Hawaii Public Radio has delivered independent news and cultural programming of the highest quality to its community of listeners. I'm pleased to proclaim February 14th through the 20th, Hawaii Public Radio Week. Please join me in congratulating HPR on its program realignment. Your support of this important community resource has made its growth possible.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, the meaning and the history of the presidential executive order. First, your quiz.
Unihoa, olehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu. umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhawaii.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're taking a trip to Sweetheart Rock, a.k.a. Pu'upehe, located on the southern coast of Lanai. At the top of the rock sits a structure people once thought to be a tomb. Now, a legend associated with this area tells the story of two lovers, a maiden from Lahaina named Pehe and a warrior from Lanai named Makakehau. Now, we'll tell you more of the story a little later, but if you know it, you may also know that archaeologist Kenneth Emery investigated and found no human remains in the area, despite the fact that it looks a bit like a tomb. He did find remains of a different kind, though, and for today's Backyard Quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us exactly what he found. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and the first one to get it right gets the HBR prize.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
Presidential executive orders have the force of law subject to judicial review. That's a lesson our new president learned only recently, and it's one of a number of events that have opened a nationwide discussion about the limits of presidential discretion and presidential power. Some past executive orders are celebrated by history, the Emancipation Proclamation, and others like Executive Order 9066, the one that led to Second World War internments of so many Japanese Americans, are seen as shameful memories. Andrea Freeman is an assistant professor of law at the University of Hawaii Manoa. We asked her to share some perspective. Good morning.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
All right.
Good.
I wanted us to talk because that's a term that has popped up in the news with great frequency lately, and it makes me wonder what the average citizen's understanding of it is.
I agree. It can be very confusing for people who have not even thought about these orders before.
Well, how are they supposed to work? Let me put it that way.
Okay. Well, under the Constitution, the president has a lot of powers that we call under his inherent authority,
mm-hmm.
which means they're not actually written into the Constitution, but they're assumed that they go along with his duties.
Mm-hmm.
And executive orders come under that inherent authority.
Right away, when you use that word assumed, you're in trouble, right, in terms
right.
of interpretation.
That's right. So an order can be written by a president, but it can still be challenged.
Yeah.
And brought to the judiciary to see whether it's constitutional or not.
Well, the definition I saw basically is that it has the force of law, assuming, there's that word again,
mm-hmm.
it has the force of law if it complies with existing statute and the Constitution.
Correct.
But you can't make an unlawful executive order. And that's kind of what happened with the one on immigration, isn't it?
Well, we don't know yet. So you can make one,
uh-huh.
right? And then it will either be challenged or not.
Mm-hmm.
So a president could write an executive order that was unconstitutional, but if nobody challenged it, it would stay in place.
Wow.
And so you're talking about the one that's commonly known as the Muslim ban?
Right.
So the Ninth Circuit so far has only ruled on whether or not to keep that ban in place or to keep what's in the order in place or not,
mm-hmm.
while the district court is reviewing it.
So
we really don't have any pronouncements by any court as to whether it is constitutional or not at this point.
Is this going to then have to go to the Supremes?
It might.
Mm-hmm.
So what has to happen first is that the district court is hearing, they're collecting briefs on the issue of a preliminary injunction. The only thing that's been issued so far is a temporary restraining order,
mm-hmm.
which you don't need to show a lot to get. You have to show that there is an irreparable harm going on,
mm-hmm.
and that there's a likelihood of success on the merits for the party that's requesting this temporary restraining order.
But what you're telling me is that it's not over yet with that particular executive order, right?
It is. It's barely beginning.
Wow.
Yeah, it has barely begun. So even though the public is perceiving this as blows to both the order and to the president, in fact, we haven't seen much of substantive discussion on the merits of the order yet.
Well, just looking, you know, sort of far ahead into an imagined future, when, for example, a great many federal judicial appointees are the president's own appointees, could we be heading toward a climate where, as you said, if a presidential order, even if it's unlawful or unconstitutional, if it goes unchallenged, it's in force? Does that open up the possibility of a climate in which the president's own appointees go ahead with future executive orders, be they lawful or not?
Okay. So there's a couple of things I need to pick up on there. And so the idea of whether something is constitutional or not is a matter of interpretation.
Right.
Right? So to say that he would write something that is unconstitutional, that is only so if it's decided to be so. Right? So you even discussed the executive order about Japanese internment. As you know, we have the Korematsu case that said internment was not unconstitutional. Right? Even though the way you're referring to it sounds like you think it was. And many people would agree with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And then it's not the judges that would be challenging the orders. Right? Because you're talking about the federal judiciary appointee.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So, for example, we have the ACLU, and they have slogans out now saying anything he does that violates the Constitution, we're going to be there and sue. Right? So the people that would be suing would be either organizations like the ACLU or states like we've seen now with Washington and Minnesota, or individuals harmed by the orders.
You need a plaintiff.
Yes.
But doesn't it at some point go before, but you know, the decisions are going to be made by...
And we already have decisions now where judges have said, I don't see a problem with this order. Right, on the district court. We had one in Boston. And so different judges have been hearing these cases that have been brought all over the country. Some have said, I think it's okay, and some have said, it's not okay.
Which leaves an awful lot. So it becomes now a matter of where the order is implemented, that it's that there's judicial discretion in different parts of the country, different opinions.
So can I explain something else? What's significant about what happened here is that the judge in Washington decided to do a nationwide stay. Okay. And so even though it was brought in one state and the government argued that the decision by the judge should only apply in that state, the judge said, no, this is going to apply throughout the country. And even the ability to do that is contested. It's not settled law whether that's constitutional or not, but it is done.
Yeah. So this is far, far from over. And that's a perspective. I suspect that John Q. Citizen doesn't really, including me, doesn't realize that.
Right. Yeah, no, it literally has not really begun.
Well, this will be, I hope we get to talk about this. I'd like to keep in touch with you in the future as this evolves, because this is one of those stories that's obviously not going away.
Absolutely. I would love to keep talking about it.
Thanks very much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Andrea Freeman is an assistant professor of law at the University of Hawaii's Richardson School of Law, where she teaches constitutional law, federal courts, and race and law.
When you think back over some of the recent stories, which ones do you most remember? One that might have made an impression is the story of the toddler assault and the mismanagement of the HPD investigation. It was a story that became an editorial last Friday from Civil Beat. Editor Patty Epler joins us now with an update to that reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. How are you?
Well, doing okay. But you know, the story of Peyton Valiente just seemed to just cut parents to ribbons to know about this little child who was beaten and the way in which the investigation certainly didn't represent any form of best practices, far from it. And you were able to move the needle on that story. What's happened since?
So the story also moved acting Honolulu Police Chief Kerry Okamoto, and he announced at the Honolulu Police Commission meeting on Wednesday earlier this week that he was going to really look into this case and really try and find out what happened with the investigation into Peyton's assault, which appears to have come while he was being, you know, taken care of at a daycare that was run by the wife of a Honolulu police officer. But I think one of the more important things that Okamoto said is that he's also going to review other sex abuse cases to make sure that his officers have followed the standards and protocol on all of those. So it's kind of rippled beyond just Peyton Valiente now, which is really great.
Many of those cases Civil Beat has reported on, we've used those as reality checks, and it seems to be also dovetailing with the fact that now the police commission is looking for a new police chief.
Yes, and so, you know, who knows what the politics behind all of that is, but certainly Acting Chief Okamoto has stepped up and is doing the right thing in this instance, and we'll be looking more closely at the police commission and its search for a new police chief next week.
So I would imagine that we will be having at least a reality check about some of what you found.
Yes, hopefully that's true.
Well, thanks very much for the update on this one. This was a story that really rippled through the community in huge ways.
Well, and it was great because the community really stepped up too and really had a lot to say about it. And I'm sure that was in Chief Okamoto's mind as well, that he heard from the public so much on it.
That's what they call impact. Thanks very much. Yeah. Talk to you next Friday.
All right. Thanks, Beth Ann.
Patty Epler is the editor of Civil Beat. One of the things we do on a Friday morning is to take a look at what we might expect to hear from our news department come Monday and throughout all of the coming week. And to help us with that, Phil Dorman, HPR's news director, is in our studio. Good morning. And dare we say, rail, rail, rail?
Yeah, you know, Beth Ann, there's a reason why so much ink is spilled and airwave time is donated to rail, because there are so many angles of this story. And as it continues, one of the things, as you know, Noe Tanigao has been taking a different sort of approach to some of these rail stories, stepping back and trying to take a look from the perspective of a citizen who may not be knowledgeable about every detail about the arguments that have come, but having some basic questions to really pull the lens back and say, hey, wait a minute, how did we get here?
Right, because there are so many people we know who have moved into Hawaii in the last 10, 20 years who may not have that full complement of, you know, information that someone who has been here for 30 or 40 years and can say. But remember when? It's really being able to put that into context.
And it's great. I mean, again, it works with a lot of other coverage. When you had the recent town square about at rail and, or at grade and at
with Scott Wilson,
level,
yeah.
Exactly. Getting to the point of where we are now and talking about what are the options ahead, it's useful sometimes to look back at history. So, for example, Mufi Hanuman, former mayor and a big champion of the rail project, and then we sat down with him, talked through some aspects of, again, how we got here. And Toru Hamayasu, who was the chief planner in the Transportation Planning Division, Department of Transportation Services, as they were putting this together. It really, knowledge of the past and history always informs the present and the future as well.
I remember when Moving Hanuman sat right there where you are sitting right now for a town square, and we talked about a lot of those issues well before we had the referendum in 2008. Very interesting. Let's even go back and pull some of that, too.
Exactly. You know, one thing I should mention before we go, the Hawaii Association of the Blind has its 50th anniversary state convention coming up a couple of weeks. Helps out other nonprofits who work with the blind all year long, getting financial support. We're going to hear a lot more about that this afternoon in the 5 o'clock hour of All Things Considered. Dave Lawrence talking with Landa Phelan, rather, board member of Hawaii Association of the Blind. But a lot more coming next week as well.
I love those helping hand segments. Such a good thing that he does. And we'll talk to you next week.
You bet.
Because we'll all be back here on Monday. We hope you'll plan to join us. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. And it is time for us to read your letters and email. After Wednesday's segment with Hawaii Restaurant Association President Greg Fraser about Senate Bill 1109, which would ban the use of polystyrene containers, Facebook was abuzz with comments. Here's one of them. Jennifer Cox wrote, "The interview has been so frustrating to listen to. The cost between using polystyrene containers and compostable alternatives is not 3 to 4 times different. In some cases, alternative products are cheaper than polystyrene. As for efficacy, Whole Foods serves soups in waxed paper containers that keep the liquids perfectly warm and intact for the ride home. Just did it a few days ago myself," she says, "and he completely misses the point about the litter issue. Yes, both types, when discarded irresponsibly, are litter, but as litter, the compostable materials are much less harmful to the environment long-term than polystyrene. Of course, the goal is to stop litter from happening altogether, but when and if litter happens, let's minimize the harm by using the products that present less risk."
Madeline McBite-Lampson wrote, "Sure hope Bill passes, as much of the testimony the last go-around gave evidence of how dangerous styrofoam is to health of people as it leaches into food. It pollutes the environment and the ocean and is dangerous to marine life. Over 100-plus restaurants on the Big Island have already voluntarily stopped using styrofoam containers for takeout."
And Rose Darling from Kihei shared this after my interview with Relationship Director Justine Finn. She said, "A few weeks ago, I foolishly let my kid look for children's Zumba on YouTube. Next thing I knew, she was watching Barbie. Suffice it to say, the laptops are now hidden and in the kitchen cabinets and smartphones password protected. Great informative interview with this woman. Lucky for those who can see her at HPA."
Thank you for the letters. And our talkback line is 808-792-8217. Or you can always email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Miki Aoki performs solo piano works from Handel to Paul McCartney in an adventurous program in HPR's Atherton Studio. This frequent guest artist at prestigious music festivals around the world debuts here Saturday, February 25th. Tickets at 955-8821 during business hours or at hbrtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, completing the 15th year of their Kaipu Aina program, partnering with charities that clean litter from our islands, shores, and parks. Learn more at matson.com/foundation.
Young girls continue to be shown they could have a future in STEM careers, and pop culture is giving it a boost. The film Hidden Figures is about the female brains behind the John Glenn mission, and it continues to draw audiences and acclaim since its release in early January. Education, though, has taken a more conservative turn with the Trump administration, and we wondered how women currently in STEM careers, and who would like to see their ranks swell, look to the future of STEM. Dr. Helen Turner is a professor of biology and is the Dean of Natural Sciences and Mathematics at Chaminade University. She'll be leading a panel on the 23rd Annual Science Symposium for Girls at Sacred Hearts Academy tomorrow. She's in our studio, though. Today. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Nice to have you here. Now, there seems to be this dichotomy of all the effort that we pushed into showing girls what they could have in a STEM career, and yet when they get out and go looking for those careers, they aren't exactly welcome or at least well supported. How do you look at that as being a woman who has been for so many years in a STEM career?
You know, I think you're right. I think that, you know, looking at the fact now we have about 25% of the STEM workforce in the U.S. are women, and we have to now ask the hard questions about the big push that we've made in the last decades. How has that got us to this point? And, you know, I think a lot of us who are involved in STEM pipeline development feel that we've sort of fostered STEM engagement in young women. We've built pipelines. But we didn't yet fix the system that they're going into. And so I think when you still see statistics now where at about 10 years into their science career, we just hemorrhage women, right? We lose them in unbelievable numbers from the profession. And so, you know, we haven't fixed that systemic lack of engagement of women and lack of advancement in women in the profession.
And at the 10-year line, I mean, it doesn't take a whole lot to think about the fact that they're probably coming into the time in which they may be having families or having to deal more with their families, adding to their families, and that seems to be an unwelcome occurrence in the STEM community.
Right, adding children to your career profile, adding, you know, caring for elderly relatives. I mean, all of these things that we know from the social science literature just proportionally affect women in every sector of the workforce, and that's also true for STEM. I think that we have not, there are isolated initiatives all over the country where you look at campuses, academic institutions like Berkeley becoming family friendly and really asking the hard questions about what does it mean to do that, what kind of resources you have to allocate to do that. But it's not yet systemic. It's not yet part of the way that we choose to do science as a community.
So what are those questions?
So I think, you know, when we think about it, we have to look at the way that science itself you know, discriminates against women. So, you know, there's been some very high-profile cases recently. You know, gender inequity in the peer review system has been exposed. And there have been these very high-profile cases of women experiencing sexual harassment systemically, either from, you know, leading figures in the field, sometimes very famous scientists. And, you know, and simply, you know, when they're going on field trips, there's a huge amount of literature now on what's happening to women when they're in the lab, when they're in the field. And so, you know, I think the cause for optimism, though, is that these things have come to light. You know, and that's the big thing that I think has changed in the last few years, is that we're starting to see exposure of these issues. And with that will come more vigilance about them and also more self-advocacy when they face them for these young women who are going into science. And we have to have some optimism, I think, that there are more female role models and more female mentors who are receiving the women that we push into science through these pipelines. I'm not saying that there are enough yet, but there definitely are a lot more than there used to be.
We know a young woman who is in her early 40s, mother of two, also going through or also went through a doctoral program here as a postdoc, thought she was going to be able to get a lab of her own. Mm-hmm. Her husband, also a postdoc, he was given the lab. She was given sort of the spousal consolation prize.
And that's a pattern that one sees over and over again. I think that as scientific families are often forced to live geographically separated existences, you know, that places a lot of stresses, and it's a choice that a lot of people just don't want to make. And I think, you know, when we look at when women drop off of the scientific radar in their 30s. I mean, I believe we see, you know, all of the things that the literature says, you know, commitment to family, all this, but a lot of women just get tired of the fight. And I think especially if trying to maintain your family structure becomes part of that fight, that's an enormous pressure.
And that seems to be borne out by the fact that, as you said, we only have 25% of women mm-hmm. continually in STEM. And maybe perhaps the other 75% are counting on that fact?
Right, right. I think that that is, you know, what happens to that other 75% is being tracked. I think there's an increasing amount of literature now. There was a great study in 2014, actually. It came out of Scotland. And they looked at the economic cost of women exiting the science pipeline. And they were able to put, well, not a dollar value on it, but a pound value on how much is this actually costing our economy. And it was a very big number, in the hundreds of millions of pounds. And Scotland doesn't have a huge scientific community. So if you think about what that is doing to an economy like the United States, which is so innovation dependent, then I think, you know, you can really start putting numbers to this, and this is when systems start to move. You know, I also think the other sort of cause for optimism, I believe science itself is changing. You know, having done this for many, many years now, the system I came up in, most women of my age came up in, is where you have, you know, a very hierarchical structure, a laboratory or a field unit, usually run by one very powerful figure, often, historically, that would have been a male. And you will see that that person has the direction of the science agenda and the power of kind of life, death, and career progression. And when that's good, it's very good. When it's bad, it's horrid. And now I think science is changing to a much more open, team, collaborative way of doing science. And I think that's really going to play to women's strengths.
So what I hear you say is that the system may, in fact, be undergoing a self-correction that may, in turn, be much more welcoming to some of the girls that you may be talking to tomorrow that are now only in fifth or eighth grade.
Right, absolutely. And I think that, you know, now that we're training young women to think about science in a way where they'll be working as part of a team that's transdisciplinary, that's usually international. I mean, that's a source of great excitement. But also, I think, as I said, it's something that's going to play to the strengths that women bring to the scientific endeavor.
There'll be a lot of women who'll be hoping you're right.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for coming in. Dr. Helen Turner is a professor of biology and the dean of natural sciences and mathematics at Chaminade University. She'll be leading a panel discussion at the Science Symposium for Girls tomorrow.
Aloha, I'm David Green.
And I'm Rachel Martin of Morning Edition.
And we would like to wish Hawaii Public Radio congratulations on their 35th anniversary.
And congratulations on the exciting program realignment starting Tuesday, Valentine's Day.
Morning Edition will still be coming to you every weekday morning on the HPR One news stream.
Thanks to all the station members whose support brings our show to HPR listeners and who make possible your two distinct stations across the Hawaiian Islands.
In this morning's backyard quiz, we took a trip out to Sweetheart Rock, a.k.a. Pu'upehe, on the southern coast of Lanai. We wanted to know what type of remains were found on Sweetheart Rock during an archaeological investigation. According to legend, a tomb sits atop the heart-shaped rock and is the final resting place of a maiden from Lahaina named Pehe. She's believed to have drowned in storm waves while living in a sea cavern, where she was hidden by her lover, Makake Hau. Makake Hau had hidden her there out of jealousy and from a desire to conceal her beauty from other men. When archaeologist Kenneth Emery explored the structure in 1921, he did not find any human remains buried there, but did find remains of seabirds. Based on these findings, it's now thought that the structure was probably a bird hunter's heiau. And nobody got that today, but that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, a literacy program used by Hawaii students in grades 2 through 12, offering home edition with parent support in 19 languages. Achieve3000.com.
We're fighting a war. I don't think we can win, but it's a good thing, baby, but I ain't thinking.
Ron Artis II plays guitar, sings, and writes his own songs, but that's only part of his story. Like others in his prolific North Shore family, he doesn't see boundaries among art forms. He grew up painting, making movies, playing every musical instrument in his house, and collaborating with his parents and siblings on any number of projects. When you're in a world like that, you never lack for inspiration. And Ron and his Les Paul guitar are with us in our studio. Good morning, Ron.
Hey, good morning. Thank you so much for having me back.
I often think of you as somebody who grew up in an ideal environment to foster creativity in children. And what was it like?
It was a lot of fun. It was challenging, creatively challenging at times. Like you said, both my parents really believed that in having freedom of choice and freedom to create and think for yourself. So it was a lot of fun. We did music. We were all homeschooled. I started learning piano and how to write music and at an early age. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of a second nature to me growing up.
And when it's part of life in that way, there's not a lot of critical judgments of the good, better, best variety. You know what I mean? It's not that, am I good enough? You didn't run into a lot of that, I don't think.
You mean as far as quality of music?
Being very critical of you know, that there, you have to be especially gifted to be effective as a musician.
The thing that I pointed out with my parents growing up, my whole family does music, art, and different things. Mm-hmm. Some do it to different degrees. Mm-hmm. And there was one thing, I was a really arrogant young guy. So when I learned my one-string guitar solo, I thought I was the greatest guitar player in the whole town.
Well, that's a guitar player thing, as you know.
And my dad had really comical ways of, you know, bringing us back down to earth. And mm-hmm. sometimes we'd just go and he'd just grab a vinyl record of B.B. King or someone and just, you know, blow the dust off, put it on the record player, and didn't have to say a word. Mm-hmm. And our egos would shrink themselves. So, but my dad always believed in remaining humble and doing the work, rehearsing, practicing, keeping your ears open to hear what the other artists are doing, because in the world of art, there is no best.
Right.
There's just all the different interpretations. But there is a lot of emphasis on good or bad music in two different ways. And the more one that was dominant in our family was good and bad music or art come down to what you create, meaning is it going to be positive and constructive, mm-hmm. or is it going to be negative and destructive? Mm-hmm. And those were the two things that we were all taught to be very aware of growing up with our art forms. If you created a song, it had to be something constructive that would better the way of life for someone, whoever got to listen to it.
Even though a lot of your dad's music was blues-based, it wasn't Poor Me.
No, my dad loved the blues.
Yeah, yeah.
And he would sometimes write comical songs for us about, you know, waking up and it'd be a slow blues song. Waking up, going in the kitchen, finding out everybody else had been in there already and the ice cream was gone.
I could relate to that. Hey, before we run out of time, let's put together a tune.
Yeah, let's just make something up. We're going to jump in A flat minor here. And
all I need's a key.
Yeah, I know. I mean,
alrighty,
you're a legend yourself.
A choice to be the sunshine in somebody's life.
Yeah, go ahead now.
So every morning that we rise, we got the moment to be sunshine in somebody's life. If you you think you can't make it through, go ahead and let your love shine on.
Go ahead, Chris. I gotta hear your guitar a little bit.
That was fun, and you know, it's fun to just take something like that and see where it goes, right? Mistakes and all, and
it's to
create. I've always envied you, Ron, growing up. Of course, you know, I was your buddies with your dad, and watching your kids grow up in such a creative atmosphere.
Thanks, man. You are a great inspiration to me and my family as well. Watching you play with my dad and rehearse with my dad and everything.
Man. Pulling out those vinyl records, huh?
Yeah.
It's good to have you. And
thank you.
Ron Ortiz II is a multi-instrumentalist from Oahu's North Shore who will be performing at Blue Note Hawaii March 1st.
Start to rise, searching for what you keep inside. So everybody got something to say. You got to live for you never feel alive.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bronster Fujichaku Robbins, a civil litigation law firm handling major cases on all islands for clients of all sizes, from individuals to Fortune 500 corporations. BFRHawaii.com.
Every day there are so many events going on in our community, it can be hard to keep track. So as part of our new time slot with The Conversation here on HPR1, we're starting a segment with our Morning Edition host and colleague, Derek Malama, who will join us each day with a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Good morning, Derek.
Good morning, Chris.
And they're free, too. That's what I noticed about these ones that we're talking about today.
Yes, and all happening this President's Day weekend. I know you're a photographer, correct?
And a film photographer who still shoots film. So this next one is for me all the way.
Yes. Now, have you been to this film camera swap
meet?
No,
but I like this.
Okay.
It sounds great.
Film camera swap meet happening at a Treehouse, 675 Oahu Street in Kaka'ako, Saturday from noon to 3 p.m. And that's free. Treehouse specializes in preserving film photography, and it's holding the film camera swap, and that'll be held in the outdoor barn area near a Moku Kitchen in Kaka'ako.
You know, photographers who shoot film are a small but hardy group that are, you know, love to get together and say, where do you get your stuff processed anymore, right?
I know, and this place, they know, they do it, actually.
This is an information bank.
Yes. On Maui, the Lahaina Arts Society presents a free art fair at Banyan Tree Park in Lahaina, Saturday through Monday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. daily, and it's free. Many of Maui's artists will be exhibiting their works under the famous Lahaina Banyan Tree, and you can check out paintings, ceramics, photography, Chris, and lots more.
Shouldn't be hard to find either.
Right, right. Follow the tree.
Exactly.
On Oahu, there's a free concert in Kauaiha'o Church on Sunday at 4 p.m. It features the Oakland Interfaith Youth Choir. This is their first tour to Hawaii. The choir has a roster of 25 active members ages 12 to 18.
Got to be exciting for those kids, too.
Oh, yes. Yeah. First time in Hawaii for most of them. On Hawaii Island, a free concert in Kia'au on President's Day at 4 p.m. The Hawaii Youth Symphony's top youth orchestra will be performing there.
I remember they were on the top on NPR.
Yes.
From the top.
From the top. So that's at Kamehameha Schools, Hawaii.
Thanks very much, Derek.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama will be joining us each day on The Conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. And you can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. We got to make a little live music, sort of off the cuff in the studio.
It's a very good live music with a very good message.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, our friend Ron grew up in an environment where there were no boundaries placed on what their kids could, what Ron and his many siblings could aspire to.
Well, and sometimes not having boundaries is a good thing. Other times,
exactly.
We know kids really need to be shaped a bit. So it depends upon what kind of thing you're talking about, where there are boundaries or there aren't.
Well, exactly, because, you know, in terms of genre boundaries, they were not in existence for Ron. But discipline was considered very much a part of making art. And I've never heard anybody successfully find a way to get around taking a disciplined approach to that and many other things.
Yeah, that's
well.
A very good combination, though, in their family, being able to have the freedom to explore
exactly.
artistically, but knowing that it is a discipline. It's not just, well, when you feel like doing it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know,
kind of like life.
Kind of like life, yeah.
Well, that's going to do it for us as we come to the end of a first week and a new time slot. And we're very happy for those of you who were able to join us. And if you haven't for any reason, you know, you can always check out either the podcast at your leisure or tune in to the rebroadcast at 7 p.m. each evening, each weekday evening. Now, coming next week, we're going to finish up with our county council check-ins. We'll chat with Hawaii County Chair Valerie Poindexter. Also, we're going to talk about the divergence of projected visitors to Hawaii and the projected economic growth. DBED's Dr. Eugene Tian will be here.
And on Monday, we'll take a look at the state of jazz today from longtime jazz critic and local boy, Nate Chinen.
You can call our talk back line anytime you like and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. Please be sure to leave us your name and the town from which you're calling. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or me at BKOZHPR.
You can hear past shows on the Conversation page on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty is our production assistant.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. See you Monday on President's Day when we pick up The Conversation.